Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric. I am here today with Michael, and we have two films on double feature. What are the two films, Michael?
Doing Die Hard and Man on Wire.
So I'm going to tell you the theme, but you're not going to believe me.
Okay.
So I guess the theme today is secret heist films that take place in famous buildings and are based on books.
Great.
Can we just talk about the utter failure of this pairing before we just pat ourselves on the back for the next 40 minutes about how great it is?
Yeah, sure.
So the Man on Wire stuff, we can put that aside because Man on Wire, you can just put it with anything and great film. Die Hard, also a great film, would have gone, I don't know if it would have gone better with this other film, but we handled a film on the show a few weeks prior and the pairing just would have made so much sense.
Yeah. We should have done it with P2.
So here's the thing. Die Hard, obviously, you're in the building and whatever, and everybody gets that. And in P2, you're in the basement of a building, a large Empire State Building,
yeah.
Right? So, I mean, another huge building. But also, it's Christmas.
Yep.
It just would have been so perfect. And the lobby from P2 kind of looks like the Die Hard lobby. So maybe in your own time, you could watch Die Hard back to back with P2.
And it'd be great.
And maybe you could watch Taken back to back with Man on Wire. I'm not sure that makes any sense, but try that out anyways. If you want, you can actually listen to our shows that way. Do you know why you can do that?
Something about chapters.
Yes, chapters. That's exactly right. We have chapters in the show. So what you can do if you're using iTunes, QuickTime, Zune, iPad, you can go up to the chapters menu. I don't think iPad has a chapters menu, but you'll figure it out. You can go to the chapters menu and you can skip over Die Hard and go to Man on Wire. Or you could go back, listen to the P2 show, get the chapters in that, listen to P2, and then come and listen to Die Hard. Although you should probably do Die Hard first and then P2, right? That would be the order I would do that double feature in.
Yeah, probably.
You start at the top, you work your way down.
Is that kind of what's going on there? That is way high concept.
Would you call it top floor concept?
I wouldn't.
See, this is why I feel like it's good that we did this pairing and not, because we would have just had a full show of Die Hard top floor, bottom floor, basement jokes. We're going to spoil these movies. Man on Wire is a documentary. So not a whole, it doesn't surprise you at the end with what happens. I mean, there's clearly a place that the cover of Man on Wire tells you how the film is going to end. So that's fine. And Die Hard, everybody's seen Die Hard. I'm pretty sure this is a safe show for anybody to listen to.
Probably.
But if you think that you could be spoiled by our conversation about Die Hard, we're going to tell you what happens at the end because that's part of what you need to talk about. And Die Hard is where we start because the documentary just always goes second.
Yep, that's how it works.
So Die Hard is the sequel to the 1968 Frank Sinatra film, The Detective. You've seen The Detective, right?
Nope.
You're giving me this scared look. I'm just fucking with you.
Oh my God.
Well, so there was this Roderick Thorpe book, The Detective. And it was made into a movie starring Frank Sinatra.
Weird.
And then the sequel to that book, Nothing Lasts Forever, was made into Die Hard. Originally, they wanted to get Frank Sinatra to come back.
I'm just amazed at this information.
Are you blown away by this?
This information is amazing.
Well,
to
you
me.
Don't tune into Double Nap Time feature show. What is the? I always forget the URL.
Double.
For that. It
sleepy,
doesn't matter what the URL is
double
because
sleepy
that,
nap time.
That website does not exist. But yeah, you don't tune into Double Sleepy Nap Time, so you wouldn't know this important information. But yeah. Would have been a sequel to the Frank Sinatra movie, but apparently could you imagine Frank Sinatra in Die Hard?
As John McClane?
That is insane.
That's
his role in The
really?
Detective. That is crazy.
Really?
Well, there were significant rewrites that made Die Hard a different kind of movie.
Uh-huh.
Probably the mother of all action films.
I have to disagree, but I
would
can
you?
Definitely, well, it, I mean, it's newer. It's one of the newer ones.
Okay, all right. Well, you're the 70s guy, right? So, of course you're going to disagree
with
me.
Now, I'm not saying it's bad. I don't want people to take my disagreement as me saying
But it's the grandchild of what I would say is the
father of action films.
So, who directed this thing? We've actually seen him before on the show.
John McTiernan, who directed the first Predator film?
Yeah, just the first one. Between Die Hard and Predator, I mean, those are the only two of his films you need to see. Mm-hmm. What Die Hard has going for it is that its beauty lies in its simplicity. I'm going to give you 4 points
give me
that
four
I think
points.
Make Die Hard. You got one building, one action hero, one driving plot and one Alan Rickman.
One Hans Gruber.
I think those are the four things that you need.
Right.
And why don't we just take them in that order, right?
Great. All right. Let's start with the plaza.
I think, you know, I end up watching Die Hard every fucking December right around Christmas time just because that's what happens. Everybody's whipping out these top 10 lists of their bullshit Christmas whatever stupid mm-hmm. movies. And every once in a while, I will catch Die Hard on someone's list and remind myself that although it's 2 hours long, I can afford 2 hours a year to watch Die Hard. But the Christmas stuff adds to the mood. John McClane first coming off that airplane, returning to his wife, just the whole bad day movie vibe. All of that is nestled inside this beautiful Nakatomi Plaza. And this is the Fox Plaza, right? The building in one of the, four skyscrapers in the Los Angeles, the silly little Los Angeles skyline. At the time, the building was brand new. You know, all the damage and stuff was, I think it's just the exterior that they're using, but I could be wrong about that. But all the damage is done using these scale models. I don't think it's the same scale model that they actually have inside the film, if you can spot that. But I think the damage is pretty convincing. I think the special effects are pretty convincing. Especially the scene we see at the end, the spoiler scene where he falls out of the building. Mm-hmm. Although there isn't a loud Foley splat sound, which I always kind of miss when that happens.
You know, I'm actually glad. I was afraid that they were going to make a big, ridiculous big gory mess splash. Hans Gruber. But the fact of the matter is...
You see the reaction on everyone's face. That's all you need.
The fact of the matter is, when you hit the ground, you don't make a splash.
Right. Now, careful viewers will also note that they have seen the Fox Plaza on our show before when we did Fight Club. It's mm-hmm. one of the buildings at the end of Fight Club.
Yeah.
And I think it shows up in a couple other movies, none of which we've ever really talked about. But I don't think anybody but myself watches this for the Fox Plaza. I think they watch it for Bruce Willis. With hair this time
around. He has hair for all three of the Die Hard movies.
All three. That's very good of you. Well, okay. Do we need to talk about the other Die Hard movies?
I don't think we're ever going to touch on it, so we might as well at least glaze over them.
I would have been happy going through this entire movie thinking that the only other Die Hard film was with Frank Sinatra, and that's it. It's just those two.
Well, I think if we're going to talk John McClane, we might as well talk the John McClane story.
The most John McClane you ever get really is in the first film.
Yeah.
In the second film, they weaken the story, and by the third film, there is no story that really...
They add a second protagonist in the third film because it's so convoluted.
Yeah, and then...
In the fourth film, he's kind of the big thug to the plot of the film.
Yeah. I don't, you know, the second movie is snore and the third movie picks it up, but then the fourth movie drags it so far back down that I only end up ever watching the first one. Neither one of us are part of the apparently everyone else in the universe who thinks the fourth film is okay.
Yeah, I wasn't just a big fan of that at all.
But you have all the stuff in the first one about his wife. Obviously, you see his wife. You have that relationship, that kind of tension between the two of them. She is almost the damsel in distress through this whole movie.
Right.
I mean, I think as a cop especially, and you know, as we see him do in these other movies, if he finds a terrorist plot, he is going to thwart it, whether his wife is involved or not.
Sure.
So it's not just, this isn't just, you know, save the day for his wife kind of thing.
It's not a selfish thing.
In the later films, they would cut back the stuff with his wife. I think they couldn't get the actress to come back. They got a divorce. She causes him to get headaches. By the fourth film, I'm pretty sure he was a random homeless person or something that they picked up off the street. I don't really know the mythology of the fourth film at all or how that ties into this. But he is one of those Taken-like protagonists that we talked about Taken with P2 that carries the film. I think there's a couple other things. I don't know. Let's say the building and the other two whatever things that I mentioned that help carry the film. But he is where we get all of our firsthand information. Everything else we get is kind of recycled from the news reporters, from the officer he's talking to outside, from the FBI poll rank, this is out of your jurisdiction, you know, people that show up. But they're all just, that becomes an echo chamber. That's mm-hmm. just the facts after the matter, stuff they got from John that they're just bouncing off of each other. We don't get anything new from there. Everything we get is following our guy who is inside. And in the beginning of the movie, that guy is just talking to himself. He has this kind of humility where he's making fun of himself and his bad day as the time is going on. You know, when he's in the vent, when he's getting cut up, when he's getting shot at, just all those I'm having a really bad day kind of lines, just talking to himself out loud like a crazy person.
Right. Well, the other thing that's really interesting about John McClane in this film, and in I guess it's more interesting about Die Hard as a whole. we're following the inside man in this film.
Yeah.
Where a lot of times a different film, especially nowadays, we would be following Al's character. Yeah. We would have the outside man be the lead in the film, getting all this information from the inside guy, but then we wouldn't have to follow all the crazy action-packed stuff that's going on inside. We can kind of push that by the wayside and I guess make it more believable.
Yeah, maybe that's supposed to be tension. You don't know what's happening inside, but I find that we're following John McClane. That's really compelling to me. Oh, I like that better.
Yeah, me too. Well, I think that that's the strength of the film is that Die Hard kind of goes through the pains of how is this one guy going to survive instead of how is this guy going to defuse a situation when he's disconnected from the man in the building?
Well, when you think about all his interactions with the people outside, obviously he has his one friend that he's talking to. And the dynamic between them, that kind of cowboy mentality, you know, they talk about the John Wayne stuff in the movie. All of that serves to inform you more about these characters and kind of gives you that camaraderie there.
Mm-hmm.
But outside of those two, all that serves to do is tell you these people are now going to get in the way. The media circus that forms outside is going to get in the way. The officers all pulling rank and the cops and the FBI and the tanks or whatever they're bringing in, that's all just going to get in John's way. No, do any of those things ever help him? Does he ever get one single piece of information from the outside?
No.
You know, hey, there's a guy in the window up on 414. Hey, there's somebody pulling. Nobody ever says anything to him. He has to do all of this on his own and everyone else just gets in his fucking way. The plot is another thing I like about Die Hard, especially for a two-hour-long movie. This is 2 hours and 15 minutes or something, and it does not divert from the original plot. You get a bit of a twist on the story. You find out new information, which is good.
Yeah,
right. Sure. That keeps things fresh. But you don't leave the building. I mean, this isn't just the same trick that P2 is using when you're staying in one parking lot.
Right.
Obviously, you're in one building, but you go all over the place. You're on the roof. You're on the different levels. You're crawling through the vent. But the point is that the plot is these guys, they're breaking in, and they are your focus the entire time. I mean, contrast that to something like the third Die Hard.
Yeah,
the third Die Hard wears me out because I feel like maybe that's a testament to the film in that I feel like I'm going along with the characters so much I'm out of breath when they are. But the third Die Hard, if you haven't seen it, moves them through all of these puzzles and riddles and they go from one location to the other. They have to get in a cab. They have to go really fast. They have to get to a water fountain. They have to go to a subway. And I'm fucking exhausted. After 2 hours, I feel so spent. In the first Die Hard, you know exactly where you are. You're moving around this building. You're not. I always feel like I'm wasting time when I'm moving around to 30 different places.
Yeah.
That's why I like the one place. You're dealing with one set of characters. It's simple, but it's powerful. It's effective. The twist I was referring to, I think, is kind of smart, actually. It's that the robbers have disguised themselves as terrorists.
Right.
When they first break in the building, you think they're just there to blow stuff up or to take hostages, but they're not. You know, I was reading, I mentioned during the scene when they talk about the hostage situations on the TV, I think it's something like hostage, terrorist, terrorist, hostage, or something ridiculous like that.
Like that.
I was reading a book about hostage situations, and they were talking about how inside the negotiation, it was called it an industry, profession, I suppose. Having a bunch of people trapped in a building does not always mean you have a hostage situation. What they consider a hostage situation is one where the terrorists are willing to give up hostages in order to achieve, basically, if they want tangible things. If the, you know, the dog day afternoon kind of stuff.
Right.
If they want a plane out of there or a bus or money or people released and freedom fighters released or whatever. But you also have, they were comparing it to Columbine, for instance, which was not a hostage situation. It was a situation where people were inside a building. They had kids at gunpoint, but they had no intent of releasing them. Their intentions there was to kill the hostages. That makes it a completely different game for the negotiators. They were essentially talking about the different methodologies you would use in those two different situations. This is a really bizarre third kind of situation in that the hostages are almost a red herring.
Yeah.
They're not even something to be concerned with. They're there as a complete diversion to keep the cops out while they get their money and maybe form some kind of exit strategy. And then the fourth, let's call it the pillar of Die Hard,
absolutely,
is an incredible villain. We have a team of villains. So before we get to the great Alan Rickman, we also have the usual cast of characters. We have the early 90s, more of a late 80s character of the hacker. you're busting through the computers and overriding the system and fighting off the building as if it's his enemy. Always just a silly character.
And decrypting
to me.
The codes.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And uploading a megabyte.
Yeah, uploading a megabyte, exactly. I'm going to consider Ellis part of the that team too,
because he's getting in the way.
I love Ellis as a character that you can contrast to John McClane, because they both have a very noble and similar outcome in mind. They're both working to the same ends.
Right.
John McClane wants to get all the terrorists away from the hostages, and so does Ellis. Ellis just happens to be a giant douchebag.
Right.
That's one of those questions that every time I see this character in a film, it seems like something that in today's action movies, a character like Ellis is somebody they just throw in so that you hate them and eventually they can get shot in the face.
Exactly.
And so I ask myself, what purpose is this character serving? And here I think it is specifically so you realize how awesome John McClane is.
Yeah.
They're both trying to do the same thing. Ellis just thinks he's better at it, and he is so much worse at it, to the point that Alan Rickman is even... When Ellis is in the frame, you're rooting for Alan Rickman's character. Even though Ellis would get you to a better outcome, you still just want to see him get shot in the face.
Yeah,
because he's just such a jerk.
I think it also serves to make you realize that Hans Gruber isn't fucking around. I mean,
no,
as if you
and not an idiot either.
As if you didn't already know when he blows Mr. Takagi's brain all over the fucking wall.
Yeah, not fucking around. You know who's definitely not fucking around? Is his long-haired, high-forehead sidekick. What is going on with these people always in the heist films?
What, the second boss?
Yeah, the second boss. We mentioned it in the Dog Day Afternoon show. It came up again in JCVD. It comes up it came up in Hostage. It's always the guy who shows up, and he's a loose fucking cannon, and he's got long hair, and here he doesn't even really speak English. And he serves the same purpose that you called him the second boss, but he's the one who makes it out in the end.
Right.
Your cast would not be complete without this guy. But, of course, there is Alan Rickman.
Yeah.
There is Hans Gruber.
So we have a mutual friend, a friend of ours named Jeremy Mumenthaler.
Yes.
Something ridiculously interesting about him is that when he was still inside of his mother... His father was dead set and completely serious, giving him the first name Hans Gruber.
Oh, no, really? As a first name?
Hans Gruber Mumenthaler.
Oh, that would have been tragic.
But we have the real Hans Gruber. We have Alan Rickman's Hans Gruber.
I love his dry sense of humor. I mean, anytime you see Alan Rickman anywhere, that's what you say about him, right? His dry sense of humor is superb. It is fantastic. Just in that thing you were talking about with Takagi where he shoots him, alas... Your Mr. Takagi did not see it that way, so he won't be joining us for the rest of his life. I mean, just at the straight face he delivers it with, and then the terror that it creates.
Right.
Everyone else, no one sees how hilarious that is. They all just scream and panic because his brains are splattered all, and his chunky brains are all over the window. I don't know if the Die Hard movies ever get gorier than this.
I don't think so.
So I have two favorite scenes of Alan Rickman's. The first is his American accent.
Yeah.
Are you as impressed by this accent as I am? It's pretty fantastic.
It's like he's a different guy. It's because he's all shaken up. His hair gets shaken into his face.
Right.
And it immediately seems like they're using Alan Rickman as two characters for a second.
Yeah, it's almost...
You buy it. I mean, you buy it instantly.
When we do the slasher stuff and you get in the early Freddy stuff or whatever, you get the cameos by actors who would later go on to do legitimate things and... kind of become a type of character that you usually see, but they're playing something so out of type and such a cameo that it's almost like you're saying, is that really that actor?
Mm-hmm.
When you see Alan Rickman show up, he's pulling off this American accent so well that if you just walked in, you would say, oh, hey, Alan Rickman, I didn't know he was in this movie. Wow, what a weird little small role he has here.
Right, exactly.
I don't think it was in the original script. I'm pretty sure they wrote it in... after they found out that Alan Rickman could do such an awesome American accent. So he wasn't even set to meet John McClane face to face. They stuck that whole part of the movie in just to exploit his humorous and awesome American accent. The scene plays out really well, too, because it's kind of this point where you realize although these guys are adversaries, although they are completely against one another, John McClane has never seen Hans. He knows his voice, not his American voice, but his low, deep, monotonous voice. And he doesn't actually know what he looks like. And that's where the light kind of goes off, where you say, oh, shouldn't he be shooting at him or whatever? Oh, no, he has no idea what this arch foe of his, who he even is. And then, of course, my other favorite Alan Rickman scene is just that surprise fall, that yeah. Hans Gruber fall. The one sure. that is so good, they reuse it in the third mm-hmm. Die Hard when they're referring back to the first one to let you know what character he yeah. is or whatever.
Well, the Hans Gruber fall, has that drop, mm-hmm. that scene is really, I wouldn't, I'm pretty sure it's one of the quintessential action villain
oh,
deaths.
For sure.
I don't
it's
think
it's definitely
it gets,
the most iconic shot of the movie.
It doesn't get a whole lot better than, well, not only the movie, but I think in action cinema.
Yeah.
I don't think there's too much more of a defeat. Maybe Rambo 3.
I don't remember
the guy who falls in the hole.
Oh, okay.
I think yeah. that no, one kind of stands out. But it's
guy who falls in the hole is not a fist pounding villain.
Yeah,
in the
exactly.
way that, yeah.
He's more of the second guy. He's yeah. more of the long haired obnoxious
yeah,
guy.
Yeah, right. My favorite thing about that scene is Alan Rickman's performance, although it's not really intentional, because when he fell and they filmed the shot, it was I think it was the kind of thing where they were going to count to three and they released him on two. And I'm pretty sure it pissed Alan Rickman off that they let
him
go.
I can see
him
being a very agitatable fellow.
Yeah. Yeah. Stay out of his way, especially when he's playing a villain like this. There's one more element of this. It's not I don't consider it a pillar of the film, but something really weird. You notice anything strange about the music in this movie?
Yeah, it's Ode to Joy.
Yeah, what's
That's
up with that?
The music. I mean, yeah. I guess Ode to Joy is a pretty decent mix of non-Christmas and Christmas music.
Well, the first time I heard it, I went, oh, they couldn't get rights to Christmas music. They used Ode to Joy.
Well, when we did Christmas on Mars, uh-huh. one of the only Christmas songs that's in public domain is Silent Night.
Right.
And Silent Night over Die Hard would be no. ironic as fuck, but not for 2.5 hours.
No, definitely not. How many swell parties have you been to where Ode to Joy is rocking over the stereo?
It's not enough swell parties, but yet too many.
But then also it's used in the score, especially early in the movie. I don't know if it's used more early in the movie or if I just become immune to it by yeah. the end. But very ominously, there's not even any joke about it. Seriously, you guys, Ode to Joy. with sleigh bells over it. Get some sleigh bells going in the score too. And then people are humming Ode to Joy throughout the movie. It's really a heavy theme. And then there's also some bizarre cues in there. I think there's still a piece from the second Alien movie that was used as temporary score, but they never filled it in. So it's still in the final cut of the movie. Just really weird mix of sound. Another movie you wouldn't think is based on a book. I'm not going to throw you any Frank Sinatra curveballs here. But the book was called To Reach the Clouds, and it told the story of Philippe, the man on wire, the titular man of the film, and the guy who, you want to talk about someone who carries the film.
Yeah.
God, this guy is just such a performer.
And he's so French.
Yeah, he is.
I mean,
yeah.
The thing that I think is so great about this film, and I mean, I know that it touches on it toward the end of the film, but what I love about it is that it's these French kids coming to America to do such a French thing.
Yeah.
And America's arresting them. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's America putting handcuffs on French
yep.
art.
Yep.
And that's what everything America does is. It's handcuffs on French art.
Yeah. You think that's a metaphor for the entire country?
Well, no, I think that, I mean, I'm not knocking it.
Right.
I would, some French art needs damn handcuffs.
Right. They arrest him in France too, you know, where yeah. when he's performing in France, I wouldn't say he gets the same treatment. What I thought was funnier is the note they hit on at the end of the movie where everyone keeps asking him why he did it, as mm-hmm. if that even shocked me. I don't know if, you know, they chalk that up to American mentality, but I was almost a little bit offended by that.
Oh yeah.
The question of why I would not for a second. But all right, if you put yourself in their position, the entire media starts asking you why, you might say to yourself, stupid Americans, that's yeah. not even, you know, the point. You're completely missing what I did.
Well, but the thing that doesn't make any sense is Americans, when an American does American art, people don't ask why.
No.
That's the weird thing. Think about a film, you know, mm-hmm. something as simple as a film. No reporters go, why'd you make that movie?
No. So here's, you know, another weird side of that. I know you don't have any tattoos. I'm pretty sure you don't have any piercings.
I don't have any right? tattoos or piercings.
So when you get a tattoo, the first question people ask you, what does it mean? Every single fucking time, no matter if you have, I have fucking numbers tattooed on my body, so maybe I'm asking for it. But you get symbols, you get a picture, people always ask you, what does it mean? As if you need a reason to have art right. on your body. And it's, you know, it's modification. I have piercings as well. Never in my life has anyone asked me what purpose my piercings serve, what utility, you know, what do I use them for? Why? No one has asked me why. No one has asked me what the artistic message behind my fucking piercings are. But there is this odd kind of question when people approach something they don't understand, tightrope walking, for instance, where they say, why would anyone want to do that? That is so insane. And there are specific moments throughout the film where even I look at these people and say, these people are clearly insane. There is something wrong with them. To the point where they take him to a psychologist or whatever at the end of the film to see if he is actually insane. I use insane as hyperbole, but they think he may actually be insane. Someone who could orchestrate a plan like this, they would think he is insane. He has managed to sneak all of this equipment up there to line up. I mean, an engineering fucking genius to line up this rope. Just a really, really creative and pull off this feat, an incredible amount of skill. He comes back down and they're wondered if he's insane. Turns out he's just thirsty. Philippe himself is an incredible raconteur. I mean, he is so animated. His details are just astonishing. It's, you know, when you're going to be a storyteller like that, you have to do two things. You have to be a performer and a writer, and you have to do both on the spot. You know, I mean, somebody who's written their story like this obviously has some of it planned, but as you are describing the details, you have to know what your audience wants to see. That's the performance kind of part of it. And then you also have to know how you're going to illuminate these descriptions you have. And I am blown away when I think very few people can do this well. Most people who can make a living out of it because it's just one of those things. I think it might just be a natural talent. I don't even know if you... I guess hard work and talent kind of mixed there.
Right.
But he just describes his story so well. You know, even when they do the dramatizations in the film or when they cut to the other interviews, in the back of my head, I always kind of say, go back to Philippe. I just want to see him flail his arms around and kind of flow in and out of the frame out of excitement, you know, as if the camera can't contain him.
And come up with really, really odd artistic excuses for everything that's going on.
Right.
It's great.
Yeah, he's incredibly good at it. The other thing I'm struck with, and this is especially when I'm watching the interviews with the other people, is that they're aware of the consequences, but they seem to be doing their best not to think about them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is this... this lingering, maybe not question, but thought throughout the entire film, what if he falls and dies? He mentions that a couple times because he's a dramatic storyteller.
Right.
He needs to let people know that there's a very real possibility. He needs to fool people even because as the storyteller, as the first person narrative storyteller, they know that he lives.
Right.
But he needs to remind you that he could fucking die. And he is the only time that I remember, oh yes, he could die. And every other character, they seem to say, well, we realized there were consequences. We ignored them.
Well, I think that's kind of the team you need. You can't have a team of people whose mindset immediately goes to the worst case scenario. You need a team of people who are so far behind you and so little worrying about, I guess, worrying about your well-being. They're not.
Yeah.
They're worried about what you're doing and less what could happen. And they're just, I guess, going through the pains to make sure what you want to happen is what ends up happening.
Well, I think that's why you're seeing the story. I think if you had a team of people that thought about the consequences, they would not have done this.
Right.
And therefore, you would not be seeing. It's almost as if there were hundreds, thousands of people maybe who considered doing this. And all but one of them thought about the consequences, and therefore none of them did it. Here's the one team of people. This is why they're not talking about the consequences, because they happen to be the one team that didn't think about the consequences, and that is the very reason they made it to the top and they were able to do this. And luckily, none of them were fucking injured, because, you know, in most cases, that probably would have been what happened as well.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to throw one weird thing at you, and the movie is very careful never to talk about this. And it would probably be more tactful of us just to not talk about this. But it's something that drives me crazy every time I see this. There is this lingering feeling, this lingering notion, idea, I guess, of 9/11 the entire time I'm watching this film. The film does not even hint at it. They do pretty much nothing to even lure you in that direction. But for some reason, I mean, you got this as well, right?
Yeah, for sure.
I guess it's just the buildings and what they mean specifically to Americans. You I hear World Trade Center and I think about a certain television show that we both like that I won't spoil that made fantastic use of the World Trade Center. But I also think about the attacks of September 11th. And I feel like the film is very, very careful in never mentioning them at all.
And not only that, but they're also really careful in their tense mm-hmm. when they're using... They don't use... They never say anything like when they were there or the Twin Towers were this.
Well, because that wasn't the event for them. Exactly. The event was Philippe.
The only past tense they use is in describing what happened when it happened.
Yeah, right.
But not in describing events since then.
Right.
Everything is kind of geared toward what happened in 1974 and not anything that has gone on in their lives. You never find out what became of these people. Apparently, some of them don't talk anymore.
Yeah.
Some of them shaved their beards off. You don't know if Philippe and his then-girlfriend are still together.
It sounds like they're not.
You never even see the consequences of... I mean, you just see triumph. That's all you ever see.
Yeah, right. The stuff that makes me think about that a lot in the beginning and what kind of sets up the antithesis, really, of the tone of what the movie will be is you have this feeling of a heist through... I mean, they even talk about that a little bit. Everybody has different names they used, heist names that they kind of, you know, the Australian or whatever.
Right.
That they used to refer to one another. But Philippe loves bank heist movies and noir and robberies and, you know, those sort of crime dramas. And they talk about the element of crime mm-hmm. a lot, especially the man with the twirly villain
the
mustache. Yeah, the inside, another fucking heist name, you know what I mean? And you see them, the movie opens with them breaking into the World Trade Center. The first time I saw the movie, obviously the second time I know exactly what they're doing and that's right where my mind is. And I know what the movie's about the first time, so I should think about that. But just the iconography there, I have to think about bombing. I have mm-hmm. to think about terrorism. I have to think about all of these awful fucking things they could be doing by breaking the law, even though I know that's not the intentions of what the people in the van are doing. I just think about a group of people breaking in. They are violating the law and they could be doing something very dangerous. And then you also see the towers being built. And as you're seeing the towers being built, I don't know if you could recognize it. I certainly recognize a couple pieces of what would later become iconic for being World Trade Center wreckage.
Yeah.
You know, especially the three beams, the mm-hmm. crossing, you know, being lifted in and the towers being built. It's like you're seeing that parallel of the destruction, that in reverse of all of these icons that especially in America, I'm not, you know, sure if that's that's true of the rest of the world, but probably images associated with that destruction.
Yeah,
and they're changing that. They're making it something different. It's about the towers being built. It's almost like they're trying to reclaim the World Trade Center and say,
that's what it feels like. It feels like it's going, okay, we understand that these aren't there anymore.
Right.
But just at least for right now, we're going to rebuild them.
Yes.
For this story, the World Trade Center has to be here.
Right. So, and they start with the footprints. Something that we see there now.
They start from the ground up, mm-hmm. which is they start where things are now. They start
exactly.
In present day and go back in time mm-hmm. by rebuilding the tower.
Yeah. And that's where the movie starts to put me in this great mood that it really never loses mm-hmm. the entire time. No matter how much drama there is, no matter how much suspense, it's almost the entire movie that they are under a blanket waiting for the security. They keep going back to that, you know, that kind of tension. And you worry that maybe even though you sort of know that they're going to be able to pull this off, you worry that they won't, and you worry that the dreams of these enthusiastic and happy, excitable people will be crushed, mm-hmm. and you just wait the entire time to see what's going to happen. And what I love about this is just the relentless enthusiasm you see from these people. It makes me fucking love the French. That sounds so completely racist to just say all French people are excitable and happy, but you see that in French film a lot, that kind of... just humanistic joy and excitement. It's so about what these people can create, what they can do, just being excited to have life and to achieve things, just being in that moment. And that is extremely exciting to me. Mm-hmm. It's almost inspirational. It kind of makes me think, look here what I'm doing right now with my own life. It makes it hard to sit there and watch the movie thinking you're on a couch in a dark room and these people are out doing something pretty fucking incredible. But I love that. I love people like that because those people, they inspire me. They make me feel energetic. They, I think when you surround yourself with creative people like that, you tend to be more creative yourself. Mm-hmm. The other kind of people I like to surround myself with are people that are leagues fucking smarter than me.
Yeah.
And seeing Philippe talk about this area of expertise that I know nothing about.
Right.
Tightrope walking in general, I know nothing about. Mm-hmm. Engineering, I know nothing outside of the Fountainhead about. And, you know, that scene where he is, it's one thing that he's already an animated storyteller and he's fantastic, but to see him describe with those models how they are going to rig up the rope, it's something that from an engineering standpoint, if I were to read about that, it would be the type of subject that I am just barely hanging on to. I could just barely understand what's going on. But the way he explains it is so simple. It's so pure. Here, we're moving this rope from here to here. I'm going to show you on this silly little model I built here. And then normally we would hang this beam over here, but that's clearly not going to work. So we're going to hang it over here, and that's going to keep the rope steady. It makes so much sense. It shows that not only does he have all of this knowledge that I don't, but he also has knowledge enough to say, this is how I'm going to convey this to an audience that has no idea what the fuck I'm talking about. It's just really impressive. It's something that very, very few people in that field can do. When I went to school for programming, that was a problem that, you know, the entire school was riddled with. How do programmers try and teach all of this crazy shit to people in a way that's inspiring? It's something you see in science and math very, very often. I always think about Neil deGrasse Tyson when that kind of stuff comes up, the astronomer, and someone who, Carl Sagan before him, who is very inspirational and can bring extremely heavy concepts down to an audience at a very basic level where they can understand them, not feel talked down to, and feel inspired by those things. Something that's incredibly hard to do from a man who has a skill set beyond this kind of architectural knowledge. Right. But he's also, I mean, think of the feat that this guy's accomplishing. He has to go up to the top of the World Trade Center. It's one thing to sneak in there, to bring all of this equipment, to do it without being caught. Then he also has to think about things like weather conditions. I mean, even on a perfect day, this would be an insane thing to deal with. But then he's got the wind stuff. I mean, it's illegal. There's just so much pressure on him. Even if this were controlled, and they go back to that a few times, even if this were something where they had planned it out and they had gotten permission, it would still be impossible. It would still be fucking insane. But then on top of that, there's the other layers. He might get, he's going to get arrested. Yeah. As soon, they bank on that. They know he's going to get arrested as soon. It's almost sad if he doesn't, because that means no one saw it. You know, so he's going to get arrested when he gets down from here. He has to find other people who can go in on this, as well, and help him with this, and who won't bail out at the last second,
right,
as always happens in the heist film, and as happens here with him, you know, as well. It's just another one of those things that reminds you how incredible the feat is, but even more how incredible the people that accomplished it are. And if that wasn't enough, he crosses back and forth 8 fucking times. What a show off, right?
Whatever.
I love that the police go up there. The police, by the way, are so completely taken aback by this that they don't even, they try and arrest him, of course, but he's taunting them. He walks all the way over to him. I just keep thinking to myself, man, I would be so relieved to be done with this and get down.
Yeah.
But of course he's not. He's passionate about this. So he turns right back around and walks the other way. And, you know, the police reach out to him and he taunts them by turning. Well, I mean, what are you going to do, right?
Yeah.
I guess you could send the helicopter out to, what, scoop him up in a net? I don't know what their plan is there. But he has that kind of control, even if it's just while he's on the rope. And it's really just the cherry on top of the sundae at that point. All right, I'm out of breath. I feel inspired and sad all at the same time that these fantastic movies are over and that I'm here sitting in a chair in a studio when I should be out doing something more amazing. If you're doing something amazing, doublefeatureshow@gmail.com is where you can reach us. Send us your pictures of walking on a tightrope on the World Trade Center.
Yeah, if any of you have any of those.
And if you have nothing to send us, you can waste some time by going over to doublefeatureshow.com, poking around in there, finding some more documentaries that we've done. We've got a good handful of those. And find some Killapaloozas while you're there as well.
Yeah, something like that.
Because you just want more action in your life. We have more movies coming up next time. What are we doing?
Next time we're going to do a Stephen King thing.
Oh, it's time.
We're going to do Christine, which is the John Carpenter, Stephen King joint. And then we're also going to cover Misery, which is not John Carpenter at all.
All right, so before we go into this, two things. Number one, you've always been down on the Stephen King. As time goes on, are you getting less down on the Stephen King, or are you still right there with the no Stephen King?
I don't like Stephen King. I think that some filmmakers can do good with Stephen King. I will also admit that Stephen King does some stories that don't have hoodoo, voodoo, bullshit, witchcraft, deus ex machina shit in it.
All right.
And fortunately, those are the ones we're going to cover.
All right, great. You know, it's weird because you told me right at the beginning of the show, that was one of the first things I ever learned about horror, is that Stephen King apparently sucks. So says you. And I've been very careful not to just blindly agree with you because I've never read any Stephen King. So for this show, I decided I'm going to read some Stephen King. So I'll have at least a little a fresh perspective.
Yeah.
Those books are all 1,500 fucking pages.
Every
what
one
the
of
hell
them.
Is... Where do people find time to read this shit?
They're not listening to our podcast.
This is ridiculous.
They're not doing our podcast.
Yeah, maybe that's it. You know, it's sometimes we watch a movie by a director that I didn't know, and in preparation for the show, I will go and watch all the director's movies. And it'll be ridiculous, and it'll take, you know, a week or something, but I'll go and do it. So I said to myself, I'm going to go read all the Stephen King books, and I cracked the first one open, and you'll see if I even fucking finished it next time here on Double Feature.
Great. Watch more fucking film.
Bye.